Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday to take your calls if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith. I'd be glad to hear from you today. If you would like to call and ask such questions, we will discuss them here together. If you have alternate viewpoint to that of the host and would like to balance comment, we'd welcome your call for that purpose as well. You'll need a phone number. You'll also need an open line, which we don't have any at the moment. Our lines are full, but we will be, of course, having open lines opening up as we talk to the present callers. So keep this number handy, and when one caller moves along, then you can call this number and get into their spot. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And our first caller today is Dennis from Oakhurst, California. Dennis, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Hi. Did you get a chance to finish our conversation yesterday? By the way, we had a major fire up here, and it looks like things are under control, thankfully.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah, I went right through the town and started 200 yards from our church. And,
wow.
It burned hundreds of acres, and it did not touch our church building at all. So that was a blessing right there.
Praise the Lord for that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so, well, anyhow, I didn't get to hear your response. We got cut off yesterday, and I wanted to just hear what you thought about, you know, I understand, you know, what you were saying regarding Matthew in relationship to the Olivet Discourse and the parallel account in the Synoptic Gospels of
yes.
Mark and Luke and so on. And I was pointing out that, you know, I think there's a lot of speculation there regarding some of the textual differences in the Gospels. There's some value there. I just don't think it's really that influential in relationship to how we interpret the Scriptures there in that context. I think that as I mentioned, that the first century Judaism had an understanding of eschatology, and I think that the apostles' questions fit right in with that. Line of thought, and that's why they asked, "When shall these things?"
Well, you mentioned yesterday that the Jews of the time anticipated a time when God would come and vindicate Israel and so forth. And I agree that many of the Jews did have that eschatology, But the disciples at this point in time didn't identify Jesus with Yahweh. They didn't know he was God yet. Even in the upper room, which was after this point, a few days later, they still didn't know he was God. So I don't know that they would have understood God coming as equivalent to Jesus literally coming, though they may have. The point here is they weren't thinking of a second coming way off in the distance because he hadn't left yet. Remember, after he rose from the dead, they said, "Will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" They weren't expecting him to go away. They were expecting him to now do the messianic work that they thought he was going to do before. And instead he went away, and they were told by angels that he would return. As near as I can tell, that was the first time they ever really grasped that Jesus was going to be gone for a while and then return. It's not as if he hadn't said things about it that could have informed them. I just don't find evidence that they knew it.
I agree that they were probably thinking about judgment. Jesus was saying, you know, that this temple won't stand one stone upon another. So, but they would easily link judgment on Israel with an end time scenario is all. So it wouldn't be a far leap at all for them to link that to the end of the age being not just AD 70, but in their minds they would see that as all one event. But clearly, history has proven that out to not be the case, but that it's been extended out to 2,000 years plus. So that's where I think I would differ with you regarding, you know, how I would approach that setting there. But what really inspired me to call you originally was that there was a young man that called you last week, and he was talking about what's happening on the earth, and he was, you know, kind of motivated to, you know, search this out because of all of the turmoil that's going on in the world. And you kind of seemed to discourage him from that pursuit because it was like, in your mind, you know what, that diverts us from what's most important and it shouldn't it shouldn't be something that we focus on as far as any the signs of the Lord's return, you know, because of the saying that says, for you know not what hour your Lord does come. And it, for me, Steve, I mean, it's exactly the opposite. I think that the scriptures bear out that, you know, watching and being sober certainly includes, you know, walking a life of holiness and obedience and loving people sacrificially. That's being sober. But it also includes, you know, when you see these things begin to come to pass, you know that your redemption draws near, that actually looking for his coming is actually in the scriptures in multiple places a motivation for holiness. It's not a diversion. Now, I believe there are ditches on both sides of the road. If you're overly focused on all the details and every time a new president comes up, his name comes up as 666, you know, that's definitely a diversion. But if you're not looking for the signs of our Lord's return, then I think that we're failing in that very strong motivation to be prepared for his return, to live that sacrificial life, to fulfill the Great Commission. You know,
so you think that a person would not have the motivation to live a sacrificial holy life if they were not persuaded that the second coming of Christ was near?
I didn't say that. I do think it is a motivation. I do not think, if it's properly balanced, that it is a demotivation for holiness. It's exactly the opposite. And I'll just say this. I believe that Christ has wanted his church throughout the ages to expect his potential return most likely in their generation. I think the apostles clearly thought Jesus was most likely going to come in their generation. And the Lord wants it that way because he knows our nature. He wants us expecting his return, looking for his return, and that we lose a potential motivation for holiness if we're not doing that.
Well, I don't think we lose anything by thinking that the coming of Christ might be thousands of years off. I don't think God wants us necessarily to think what isn't true. You know, you said you think he wants every generation to think that his coming could be or might probably be in their own time. Well, since every generation that has thought that has been believing something that wasn't true because his coming wasn't in their time, that's suggesting that God wanted them to believe something that wasn't true. See, my understanding is that the church loses credibility by crying wolf again and again and again. Someday the wolf will come, but who will be listening anymore? Because the church has so wrongly cried wolf. Jesus is coming soon, Jesus is coming soon. And they didn't have any biblical basis for saying so. And I don't think they have more so today than they did then. Now, I realize you think differently. You think there are things happening in the world that point to the second coming. And so did Hal Lindsey think that 40 years ago. And so did William Miller think that back in the 1800s. And so did people throughout church history. They thought they had a list of things that indicated that Jesus' second coming was near in their time. And, well, they were wrong. Now, the question I would have is, what would make us think that our list of things is the right list and that their list was the wrong list? Why should we think that we're right when they were not right? Now, I believe that the coming of the Lord is nearer than when we first believed, because obviously anything in the future is closer today than it was yesterday. And therefore, we can say, as Paul did, the Lord's coming is nearer than when we first believed, but we don't know. And I don't think God wants us to be speculating as to whether his coming is going to be in the next few decades. When people get into that kind of speculation, they end up in many cases, they become very obsessed with it. And when it proves to be not true, take Hal Lindsey's ministry, for example. He made his whole ministry on the prediction that the second coming was coming imminently. And he was wrong. He predicted the rapture would have to come by 81. It didn't happen by 81. He projected it out. He was wrong. When this man has lived his life out and lies on his deathbed and looks back and says, did I use my ministry opportunities fruitfully? I don't know what he'll think, but if I was in his position, I'd say, you know, I spent my whole time speculating about the end of the world, and I had all those opportunities. Every sermon I preached about the end of the world could have been a sermon about discipleship, about obedience to Christ. Now, I'm not saying Hal Lindsey has neglected to talk about those things. Hal Lindsey believes in obedience to Christ and discipleship. But his books and writings have essentially been about one thing. And if he turns out that he was wrong, and so far he has turned out to be wrong a number of times, if his entire life is spent speculating about the second coming and it doesn't happen, I don't know. If that happened to you, wouldn't you think, man, maybe I should have used my ministry doing something more in line with what was reality?
Well, Steve, let me ask you this. You know, I'm not a follower of Hal Lindsey. I don't believe in his eschatology. I'm not, certainly not a Millerite. But I would say that the Apostle Paul, clearly, and Peter and James, that they were looking for the Lord's return in their generation. Jesus, let me ask you this. Did Jesus know the truth prior to his ascension? Did he know the truth regarding his second coming?
He didn't know the time of it, no.
But that's the point. That's the point. And I think there's a reason for that. I think the Lord has wanted his bride to be expecting and looking for his return, and yes, looking for signs to see, you know.
But didn't Jesus say to his disciples, it's not for you to know the times or the seasons that the Father has put in his own power? So if it's not for us to know, why should we research it? If it's not for me to know.
You shall receive power is the immediate next verse.
Right, exactly.
After the Holy Ghost is to come upon you. So here's the point. Paul in Thessalonians, he says that you will not that they should not take you as a thief, for you know the time and the season. So
that's not what he said. That's not what he said. He said that you are not children of the darkness. You're not children of the night. His coming should overtake you as a thief. What he's saying is that when Christ comes, he will not be like a thief, an intruder breaking into your house, and you are involved in drunkenness and night activities like he describes there in that chapter, 1 Thessalonians 5.
Because you're watching, because you're looking, and you're aware that the thief.
And what does it mean to be watching?
Dennis,
what does it mean? What does it mean to be watching?
And everything that I said at the beginning of the call, which is holiness, obedience, sacrificial love, and looking for the Lord's return in relationship to what's happening in the earth, the birth pangs, the Odin.
Okay, well, Dennis, we'll just have to agree to disagree, because I don't see anything in the Bible that obligates us to make speculations about the nearness of the coming of Christ.
No, I'm not talking about making speculations. I'm talking about having a studious heart that is humbly looking for the Lord's return and seeing that when you see these things begin to come to pass, to lift up your heads, for your redemption draws near.
But then Jesus said, when Jesus said that, he said, this generation will not pass before all these things are fulfilled. So I think he was right. I think he was right.
I think everything in the Olivet Discourse was fulfilled, and every single point of the Olivet Discourse was fulfilled in AD 70.
I think everything that came before that prediction probably was, yeah.
Well, I agree with you that AD 70 is included, but clearly, you know, he covers the last 2,000 years in verses 4 to 14 in Matthew 24, and then he covers AD 70 in verses 15 to 26, and then he covers the second coming in 27 to 31. This is
that's one interpretation. It's not mine. Yeah.
And that's okay that we disagree, but I do want to just say this, and I'll let you go because you have other callers. And that is that I would just want to say that I do not think a balanced exegetical approach to trying to determine, you know, if the Lord is coming in our generation, not tomorrow, but in our generation.
What I'm saying, Dennis, is we don't have any way to know that.
Well, we do. We have a list of things to look for.
No, everything on that list has happened for the past 2,000 years.
That's not true. That is not true.
Okay, which things, what are the things on the list you're referring to? What is the list?
Well, it's the birth things increasing in intensity and frequency regarding wars, famine, pestilence, earthquakes, tsunamis, waves of sea roids, the destruction of Israel, which had not happened at the time Jesus spoke. That happened in AD 70. So that was one sign. The apostasy completely being fulfilled, the rise of the final end-time antichrist system. World evangelism had not been completed. That's another sign. Jerusalem being under Jewish control again and then surrounded by armies, and then the world turning against Israel. Signs in the heavens, the sun darkened, the moon not giving her light, stars falling from heaven, and the sign of Son of Man coming in heaven.
Okay, let me ask you now about that list. Let me ask you about the things on that list, if I could.
Yeah.
Okay, so wars, earthquakes, famines, there's no tsunamis mentioned. I think you mentioned tsunamis, but let's say earthquakes, famines, pestilences, and wars. Now, you would say those have not been abundant for the past 2,000 years. Now, you say they're going to increase. You say they're going to increase. Like, but I think you're saying that because Jesus said these are merely the birth pangs. And you're saying, well, your assumption is he means that just like the Braxton Hicks that a woman goes through as she's going to have babies, that they get closer together before the baby comes, that Jesus is saying these things will get closer together. You could read that in there, but it doesn't have to be read. To simply say these are the birth pangs simply means that these are the events that precede a birth. He doesn't necessarily mean that everything about birth pangs can be applied to a statement like they're going to get more and more frequent. We can believe that if we want to, but we certainly can't make Jesus be saying that. Likewise, when you talk about the stars falling from the sky, the sun being darkened, when are we going to see that happen?
Well, this is what we're looking at even now, potentially.
Okay, so we're going to see stars falling from the sky, and then we'll know that Jesus' coming is near when we see stars falling from the sky and the sun being darkened?
Actually, if you go to NASA's website, Steve, it's quite interesting that there's a huge increase of activity going on as far as meteor showers and so on. Exactly.
That's well, Dennis, obviously you and I are on totally different wavelengths about this. I don't think any of the things you mentioned are references to the signs of the end of the world, and I don't see them in the Bible said to be. I see them as references to the fall of Jerusalem, and they did happen. So we're just on different pages about that, and we're not going to change.
One last statement, Steve. I agree with you that there is terminology that's used that's metaphorical that applies to particular judgments in the history of the Jewish history. But the point is those local and near-in-time judgments are all portents of the final cataclysmic judgment of our Lord's return.
As you say. Okay. And I say there's no evidence of that in the Bible. So what are we going to do? We're just going to say you think one way, I think another, and that's how it's going to probably be when we die.
Well, I appreciate your time, and I love you, and I hope we have a chance to talk again.
Okay, Dennis. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Good talking to you again. Bye now. All right, Kyle from Minneapolis, thanks for waiting so long. You're on the narrow path.
Hey, Steve, long time.
Yeah.
My question today is about a verse in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24.
Okay.
And it says, "And the servants of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient," and then it goes through more there. I'm just curious, do you think that that's referring to... because it sounds like the qualifications for an elder or overseer are very similar to them. Do you think that that is another list of qualifications we could say apply to, say, an elder or an overseer?
Well, I would hope so. I would hope so. I mean, he's a servant of the Lord, you know. I think Paul is talking about Timothy in particular and how Timothy should respond to these false teachers and so forth.
Oh, sure.
But I agree. I mean, certainly if Timothy is told to do this, then this is a desirable trait for spiritual leaders in general. When Paul does tell Titus, excuse me, when Paul is telling Titus the qualifications for an elder, he says in Titus 1, verse 7, for a bishop must be blameless, excuse me, as a steward of God, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, hospitable, lover of what is good, sober-minded, just, holy, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and to convict those who contradict, for there are many insubordinate. And so he's basically saying, the elder has to be able to correct those who are insubordinate with sound doctrine. Now, when Paul tells Timothy in 2 Timothy 2, the servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition, he's obviously talking about the same activity that he says the elders must be involved in. He's just adding more detail about their being calm and kind and gentle and so forth and humble about it. In Galatians 6:1, you know, it says, "Brethren, if any of you are overcome by a fault, it says, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of meekness." So again, the ability to correct somebody who's either sinning or in false doctrine has got to be done by people who Paul says are spiritual and who exhibit the fruit of the Spirit, which would include gentleness and meekness and self-control and patience. So these are these are qualities that are not only for Timothy, but for anyone who's involved in leadership or in teaching or in correcting people. And so although Paul's words in 2 Timothy 2 probably are applying to Timothy's own conduct, it is Timothy as a leader, as a Christian leader, that is, you know, being told to behave this way, because Christian leaders should. In other words, it's not just Timothy who's supposed to act this way. It's all Christian leaders, of which Timothy is one.
Sure. Who this might fall under their responsibility.
Right.
Kind of a related question. I had a close friend who's actually called the program before apostatize in a real loud way. And when I mean loud way, I just mean on Facebook. He's very clear about his sort of new atheistic agnostic views.
Lovely.
And it's so painful to watch. And I'm curious, at what point, when somebody does something like that, and I know you have seen people who came to faith in the Jesus movement or at other times and have walked away, you know, how does your relationship, I mean, obviously relationship towards them needs to change. Obviously, if you don't believe in sort of the once saved, always saved doctrine, which I don't believe in, you got to interact with them like you would any other unbeliever. But I'm wondering, you know, when is it casting your pearls before swine? I mean, when is it? I don't know. I'm just kind of curious in how you've dealt with close friends that have walked away, particularly in a loud way.
Well, when I've had a chance to meet with them, I've sought to talk to them about their reasons for falling away. But actually, if they're not very open to discuss, then we don't really get together because I mean, I don't have anything to help them with except the truth.
Yeah.
And if they don't want the truth,
right,
then there's not much time wasting my time with them. If they've known the truth and rejected it, you know, I've got better people to spend time with who are more interested in what's reality.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting because I did try and meet up with him, multiple times, contacting him, he had intention like, yeah, you know, we can meet up. And then he up and moved out of the state.
No.
It was clear that he really just wanted to probably get away from anything that might offend his conscience. And really, I think, now obviously I'm going to have to sort of psychoanalyze here because I don't know his heart, but he was always somebody that really struggled with his conscience. And I think his conscience just, you know, falling into sin for him really just caused him to, I don't know, I mean...
I think the new atheists often are that kind of person—persons who don't feel like they can measure up to God's standards,
yep.
And they feel some guilt about that. So they just figure, "There's a couple ways we can do this. I can do better, or else I can get rid of God." And I think that, I mean, you know, Christopher Hitchens often said that, you know, one of his great objections to God was having a big, parent. Is supervising him, you know, watching him, spying on him all the time. And, you know, people don't feel awkward about being spied on if they're doing things they're proud of, you know? I mean, if I'm doing something I'm proud of, I'd love the whole world to be watching, you know? It's when I'm doing something I don't want, that I don't feel proud of, something that I feel guilty about, that I don't want the world or anyone else looking on. A person, and Hitchens made this point many times, many of his debates, many of his conversations, he made this point, you know, who wants a big, you know, dad in the sky watching you all the time, no matter what you do, you know? Well, people who are not ashamed of what they do, maybe, you know, but he obviously was not one of those.
It's sort of loving the darkness.
They love the darkness because their deeds are evil.
Yeah, it's, and I know with Christopher Hitchens, he had sort of a religious context in which he was born into or raised in. Or
right.
Something. I think he went to religious education or something. But
yes, and his brother's an outspoken Christian. Yeah.
Yes, right. I've heard some of his stuff. With my friend, I'll just, I guess, continue to pray for him and hope that the Lord can fix him. I mean, for him, it really seems like, it's almost like, I don't want to believe, help me with my belief, you know?
Yeah.
An inversion of that text. And then new atheism and other things really provide him with, not very good reasons, but reasons.
Well, not for a thinking person.
Yeah.
New atheism appeals to people who are shallow thinkers. I mean, it's very obvious. Very obvious. I mean, I realize that people who are pseudo-intellects, like, let's say, some of the new atheists themselves,
yeah,
and those who read them, people who are pseudo-intellects who don't know very much about rational thinking but like to think they do, the arguments of the new atheists are just right for them. You know, they're like they kind of make sense to someone who doesn't think very deeply.
Yep.
And suddenly, for the first time, someone who's never been very happy with religion says, "Oh, I've got a new viewpoint that makes more sense, and I'm a thinking, rational person because the guy who I got this from, you know, he's a zoologist in England, or he's a journalist in England who's really witty. You know, well, okay, maybe the guy's witty, but does he think clearly? If he does, why doesn't he show it in his books?" You know, if Richard Dawkins knows how to think clearly, why doesn't he exhibit it in his arguments about God? Or, you know, what these people do is they all argue from emotion.
Right.
And anyone who can think clearly can immediately say, wait a minute. Okay, let's say that everything you're saying is correct. Let's say God does look like a big monster in the Old Testament. Let's say it does make you uncomfortable to have a God looking over your shoulder all the time. Let's say all that is true. What has that done? How has that inched you 1 inch closer to believing there's no God?
Right.
You know, it's all emotion. It's all emotional objections. There's no rational objections in there.
No. Hey, Steve, I just wanted to let you know, because I've called about it in the past, I have gotten married.
Hey, congratulations.
Thank you. July 20th. And so, of course, I did get the dad's blessing eventually. And
was this the same woman that her dad was holding out?
Well, so there was a woman I called about quite a while ago.
Years ago, yeah.
Years ago. And that relationship didn't work out. And then this relationship, the dad held out for a while, and then he really did come back around, and I really respect him. And
great.
He was really blessed by that.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. So anyway, still listening and still love your program.
All right, Kyle. Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Steve.
Bye now.
Bye.
Okay, our next caller is Arthur, who's been waiting a long time, from Milwaukee, Oregon. Arthur, thanks for waiting. Arthur, are you waiting for 26 minutes, and then he hangs up when I put him on? Well, some people get cold feet just at the last minute. All right, sorry, Arthur. I mean, I'm sorry you spent 26 minutes on the phone and didn't get to talk. This means we have lines open right now. We're going to talk to Tim from Everett, Washington, next, but if you have an interest in calling, we've got a couple lines now open. The number is 1-800-438-5090. If you'd like to call in, you're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. You can call with any question you have about the Bible or Christianity, or objections to Christianity if you have them. You know, we do have those atheists out there listening. I know, because some of them tell me they listen. But they don't call often enough. I'd love it to get more calls from people who are of the new atheist breed, or anyone else who maybe isn't a Christian and wants to tell me why. We can talk about that in a reasonable way, I hope. Or if you are a Christian and you just have a question or a difference of opinion, call me. 1-800-438-5090. Tim, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Thanks, Greg. Steve, sorry.
Sorry.
First-time caller. Been listening to you for about a year and a half now, and really appreciate your show and your website.
Thank you.
I was listening to Dennis earlier talking about, looking for the end times, and I grew up on the mission field myself in a conservative Baptist, so I was taught that, the dispensational view as well, and went to college, to Bible school, and was taught it some more, and until I read the Bible for myself like you did, then I became disillusioned with it. But one of the things he kept saying over and over was, we have to look for it. We have to look for it. Well, as far as I know, and maybe you can set me straight on this, but I think the words there is watch. Watch and be ready. I think the Greek word is phylake, which means to guard, and I take that to be guarding against falling away, not guarding against Jesus coming back.
Right, exactly. You can't be looking up in the sky 24/7 hoping that maybe this will be the moment that Jesus will come back. First of all, you wouldn't get anything done. Secondly, you couldn't ever sleep. I mean, obviously, when it says to watch, he means to be like a watchman, always aware of something that might happen. you know, a watchman on the wall, it knows that they might be attacked that night, but they don't know that they will. But the watchman is there just in case it could happen. There's a real possibility. And that's, you know, to watch like that is how we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be aware that Jesus could come back, but we don't have to expect that he's going to right away and necessarily, or even have even an intuition about that. It's amazing how many people think that there's a value in having an intuition about the near coming of Christ, even if it's wrong. I don't think there's anything valuable about what's not true. If Jesus isn't coming back today, then it's not helpful for me to think he's going to, because that's not true. He's not going to come back today if he doesn't come back today. And then how could it be to my benefit to believe what isn't true when I could be spending time on the truth itself?
Right. Well, no one knowing except the Father, does that predicate the idea that you shouldn't be looking in the first place?
Well, that's it. Jesus said it's not for you to know the times or the seasons that the Father's put in his power. In other words, don't worry about that. I'll take care of that. You know, the Father will take care of that. It's not for you to worry about. Just occupy until I come.
And then the one question I did have on a millennial kingdom, you know, I have a lot of friends who argue against my amillennial view, and you know, the millennial kingdom that they describe, the utopia, is kind of like, you know, I always use the word Star Trek. It's like Star Trek, you know, everything's, no one has to get paid or anything like that. But my question has always been, because I don't quite understand it, don't we still have free will if they're during their paradigm of the millennial kingdom? Wouldn't we still have free will?
Well, on their view, yes, because at the end of the 1,000 years when Satan is loosed, virtually everybody, I mean, the nations like the sand of the seashore join with the devil against Christ, and this is supposedly after 1,000 years of Christ reigning on earth. So obviously these people still have free will to do what's wrong.
Well, then, if they have free will, I don't understand how it can be a utopian society. If we had a utopian environment in the garden and Adam, not being deceived, still reached for the apple, wouldn't we still reach for the apple during the millennial kingdom?
Well, it seems like that'd be a possibility. And you know, even with the devil locked up, it doesn't mean people couldn't sin, because you don't need the devil to sin. You can sin because you got sin in your nature. And if these are unsaved people going directly into the millennium after the coming of Christ, as premillennialism teaches, they'd be bringing their sinful nature with them. And so what the devil's what if the devil's locked up for 1,000 years? These people are sinners to the core. And so somehow we're supposed to have a wonderful, blissful, utopian world with the majority of the people there aren't released from their sinful, you know, selves. You know, it's not really what the Bible doesn't teach this. You know, the Bible doesn't teach about a 1,000-year millennium anywhere. I mean, obviously Revelation 20 mentions 1,000 years. But the question of whether this is talking about a future utopian society after Jesus comes back, well, it certainly doesn't say so in the passage, you know. So it's,
right.
You know,
well,
it's
speculation. The only
other option
I see is Jesus would have to, if he was reigning, the only way for it to be a utopian society, he'd have to be a tyrant.
Well, actually, premillennialism, at least dispensationalist writers, have said this very thing, that Jesus will rule with a rod of iron. And therefore, even though most of the people he's ruling over will be unbelievers and in rebellion in their hearts against him, they will be forced to behave because he'll be ruling like a tyrant with a rod of iron. Now, that doesn't bother them, I guess, since they're going to be ruling with him, so they don't really care how tyrannical it is, because they're not the ones going to be ruled over that way. but just the concept that Jesus, the same Jesus who walked on the face of the earth, is now going to become like a dictator, tyrant, over people who don't want anything to do with him, but he's going to have a rod of iron to force them to do his bidding for 1,000 years. I mean, you can believe that if you want, but I'm thankful the Bible doesn't teach it, because I don't want to believe what's not in the Bible. I don't want to believe that anymore. I used to believe that.
Yeah, same here. Well, I just thank you for your ministry, Steve.
Okay, it's great to hear from you, Tim.
Yep.
All right, bye now.
Bye.
Okay, our next caller is Nora from Sacramento, California. Nora, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. I'm in my car a lot, and I've been listening to you at different times, and I have a real question in my spirit about your teaching on Revelation.
Okay.
Dispensation or however you say that. You know, I listened to Dr. Charles Stanley, Dr. David Jeremiah, and John Hagee, and their teaching on Revelations, I feel, is absolutely the truth. I'm in Revelation studying now, and I read about that if you don't have the mark, you won't buy or sell or anything. How can you say that that's not going to be the future? How can you explain that away? I mean, it's very plain in the Bible, and I believe Revelation has a lot to do with the future. And I don't understand your teaching on it at all. And
Let me say this. If you'd like to understand my teaching about it, you should listen to my teaching on it as much as you listen to John Hagee's and David Jeremiah's teaching on it, because my lectures on it would explain everything that I think about it and why. In fact, if you listen to my lectures on it, which are free, you don't even have to buy them. You can get them free at my website. You would find out exactly how Scripture is used to interpret Scripture.
Yeah, well, I read and study the Bible, and I have the Hebrew and the Greek, and I have all the concordance and all that right there, and I can't see anywhere where some of your teaching, I feel, is right on. So,
which part? I mean, give me an example.
About any of it in Revelation. And yes, it talks very much about a tribulation coming on the earth that, and like nothing that's ever happened here. And somebody said yesterday, well, when is this tribulation coming? And you said there's not going to be one. I don't know how you can explain that away.
I don't. It did happen. Jesus said it would happen in that generation. What?
I believe it's going to happen. Well, anyway, you know what? God bless your ministry, and I hope you're right on, because a lot of people are listening to you.
All right, Noria, I hope so too. But whether I am or not, I hope people will study it for themselves so that they can be right on. You know, I don't have to be right in order for you to be right. You can study it for yourself, and if I'm wrong, you can find out that I'm wrong. But you haven't found out that I'm wrong. Instead, you've listened to people who are dispensationalists who have a different view than mine. You've assumed that they know best and that, therefore, whoever doesn't agree with them must be wrong. Well, I can appreciate that. I was in that position myself. I used to listen to dispensational teachers exclusively. I didn't even know there was any other kind out there. And so there was a time, and I'm not saying this to be condescending. I'm giving you my testimony here. There was a time when I would have said exactly what you said. I would have said, you know what? I read the Bible. I've got the Greek. I've got the Hebrew. I've got the book of Revelation. I've read it. I listen to good teachers. And hey, it sure seems obvious to me that this is all about the future. But you know what I hadn't done at that time? I hadn't heard any other side. Just like yourself. Now, you've heard me make allusions to a different view, but you haven't heard them argued. You haven't heard them defend it scripturally in detail. That's why I said if you want to listen to my lectures, they're free. You will hear them defended in detail, and you will find out. Well, you can just make your own decision. But most people who hear them have to admit there's far more scripture on the side of the view that I'm giving you than of the other side. And that's why I switched over. I wouldn't have switched over if that wasn't true. You know, I didn't have any interest in changing. I was in a movement that kicked me, well, didn't kick me out, but they eased me out of their movement because I didn't hold the view their movement held. It would have been much more to my advantage to continue being a dispensationalist. There's a lot more people want to listen to dispensationalists out there than to listen to what I say. So, I mean, it's not like I gained anything by changing my view. As a matter of fact, the more I changed it, the more uncomfortable I felt that I was drifting from where my friends had been. But fortunately, I found out that where I drifted to was where the church had been for most of history, and what, of course, the apostles taught and Jesus taught, instead of what John Nelson Darby taught in 1830. So that's my position. But see, what I did, the reason I changed, and you haven't changed, is because I did something you haven't done. I listened to all the views. I listened to the arguments biblically for all the views. And then I was able to make a decision, an informed decision. Now, my book, Revelation 4 Views, does not present any view as my own. my book, Revelation Four Views, but just presents the arguments for all four views. And I do that because I don't care if any of my readers or listeners come to the same conclusions I do. What do I have to gain from that? I don't care what you believe about Revelation. I'm not even interested in changing your mind. But I do think Christians would do well to think for themselves after having heard the evidence. And that's what my philosophy of teaching is to let people know what the evidence is and get them to think biblically for themselves. And so that's why I wrote the book Revelation Four Views. It just presents the four views. It doesn't even identify mine. And, you know, it says in Proverbs, he that is first in his own case, in his own matter, seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. This is always true. This is a great observation Solomon made about human nature. The first person who argues his case sounds right. Then you hear the neighbor. You ever watch a courtroom drama? And, you know, one lawyer gets up there and he interviews the witnesses and he makes his arguments and so forth and say, wow, he's definitely right. He's got it. He's got it nailed. Then the other guy gets up there, interviews the same witnesses and so forth. And they think, wait a minute, I think maybe he's right. You see, that's how it is. If you only hear one view, it will seem right. You've only heard one view and it seems right. For a long time, I had only heard one view. It seemed right to me, too. Then I heard other views. And then I began to realize I'm going to have to do some thinking here. I'm not going to just be able to follow what my teacher said or what some new teacher says. I need to do some thinking and looking at the evidence myself in the Bible. And that's what I did, and that's what I really would encourage anyone to do. All right. Nora from Portland, welcome.
Is it Norma?
Wilma?
Am I on the line?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. Hi. He said another Norma called today. Well, it wasn't me. But my husband and I were talking last night, and we had a question that we wanted to ask you. And do you think there is any prophecy that isn't fulfilled before the coming of Christ? I mean, do you think every single prophecy in the Bible has already been fulfilled?
Well, there are some prophecies that have to do with processes. Like Jesus said, this gospel will be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations, and then the end will come. Now, the gospel has to be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations. Has that happened? Well, sure, that's been happening for thousands of years now. Is it finished happening? No, that's still going on. So is that a fulfilled prophecy or an unfulfilled prophecy? Well, it's...
What about the prophecy that a third of the people will die?
Well, that prophecy is in Zechariah, and it's, I believe, greatly misunderstood.
Well, it's also in Revelation.
Well, Revelation talks about a third of mankind dying in some plagues, too. Yeah, and Zechariah also talks about a third dying. Or actually, two-thirds dying.
There's an awful lot of things in Revelation that haven't happened yet. Really bad things that are going to happen. And I think you want to take it all like, what do you call it? You can't understand it or something like that. But I mean, I don't listen to people like Hal Lindsey or those, but I'm fascinated with Revelation, and I just read it, and I would love to believe the way you believed. To me, it would be the easy cop-out. That would be such an easy cop-out. Okay, Christ is coming sometime soon, and all these terrible things are not going to happen that I don't think have happened yet.
Well, you said, I just want to take everything such and such way. I don't really have a preference how to take them. I want to take them the way that they're meant.
Take symbolism when they're clearly not symbolism. I mean, you can tell when he's talking about Jesus as a lamb, you know Jesus. I mean, the things that are symbolism are very clear. But the things when he talks about 3.5 years, and this, to me it's very, very clear that he's talking about 3.5 years. He's not symbolizing something.
Now, Norma, let me ask you, how would you recognize if he was speaking of that number symbolically?
I don't think it would make any sense.
Really? Okay.
No.
Well, you know, Norma, you know, there's a lot of people like you. A couple of them have called today. And I'm not unaware of your viewpoint.
Because I think they're right. I think you're wrong. But
yeah. Well, I don't really have any interest in changing your mind. I just want to tell the truth. So if people ask me what I believe the Bible teaches, I'll teach it.
You're right.
What would be better about me being right?
Well, all these bad things would have happened already.
Well, why would that be good?
Why would that be good? Because then people wouldn't have to go through such these terrible things that are prophesied.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not really sure why it would make a difference. What terrible things in the future is it that you're afraid of?
Oh, I just, I think it's starting to happen right now. And
I asked what things? I mean, some specific
things. The killing of Christians. And that's always happened in the past, too. It's happened.
Right, exactly. It's always happened in the past. So, I mean, I'm asking you, what things are there in the book of Revelation, terrible things that you think are going to happen?
Well,
that,
like the mountains being leveled. And I think there's going to be a lot of earthquakes, and a lot of people die. And if you are a Christian, you're going to be singled out over the whole world. Not, I mean, it's bad enough in one country, or two countries, or three countries. I mean, that's bad. But the whole world are going to be singled out. And if they don't take the mark of the beast, they're cooked. Or they can hide and hope somebody else takes care of them or something.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, Norma, have you ever studied the book of Revelation from a different point of view than the one you hold?
I just read it.
Then you haven't.
Well, I haven't told somebody, tell me, show me how this is wrong. No, I just read it, and that's the way I understand.
Okay.
To me, it's so clear what is
okay,
symbolism.
Okay, so, well, Norma, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this. When it says, these are things that must shortly take place, is that symbolic or literal?
That's symbolic.
Now, why is that symbolic?
Because in this way, everything shortly to Jesus. There's no time for Jesus.
Okay.
Endless, and everything is shortly.
Okay.
I mean, if he said...
Well, Norma, hey, I'll tell you what, Norma.
That could mean tomorrow.
I'll tell you what, Norma. I'll tell you what.
Years.
I appreciate your right to hold your views. Thanks for calling, Norma. I've got my lines full. I certainly appreciate your right to hold your views. God bless you. Okay, our next caller is Aaron from Sacramento. Aaron, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I'm a member of the Bayside Church of Granite Bay, and I don't know if I misunderstood the woman that was on before talking about having to take the mark of the beast or anything, but unless you really know the scripture by studying it over a long time, it's not going to be someone like some of my friends think you're going to get the beast number 666 stamped on your forehead. It's like the system, world that's trying to turn to an all-world money system now. I mean, Revelations is a book about the future vision. It's a book about virtue. It's a book about verdict. It's a book about victory. And all the churches that are mentioned in there have a different meaning. Like the Losadencia book is the lukewarm church of the 20th century, Philadelphia, the true church of every age. Unless people get into it and really study the word and know it, then reading it, like when I was a first-time born-again believer and I read the Revelations, I thought Philadelphia was representing the United States Philadelphia. And if you don't know, it can be misrepresented a lot. I believe in your view, and I believe in other people's, other pastors' views, too. But what the devil has done also to us is he couldn't stop the Bible from being printed. So what he does is he gives all these different pastors' views, and that can confuse a person. I don't believe you're wrong. I don't believe, you know, other pastors are wrong. Everybody has their own view on things.
Well, somebody's wrong.
Pardon?
Somebody's wrong.
Well, I mean, I don't believe any church pastors are wrong.
You don't believe any church pastors are wrong?
Pardon?
You don't believe any church pastors are wrong?
The ones that I've heard.
Okay.
All, I mean, they've told it almost not exactly the same way, but it does. In the end, it does come out. If you're
okay, well, then I'm wrong. Then I'm wrong. That's okay. I mean, we can't say that
you're wrong, sir. I don't think you're wrong.
Well, if I'm wrong, if I'm not wrong, then they're wrong. If they're not wrong, I'm wrong. We can't have people saying contradictory things and both be right.
Well, I haven't heard any. That's what I'm saying. I listen to Hagee. I listen to Olstein. I listen to Jeremiah, Charles Stanley, Jensen Franklin, Chris Brown, Francis Chan, Ray Johnson, Kurt Harlow. And the end is always the same to me. The way they present it might be, but that's their view and their opinion. Everybody's
okay.
Got a different opinion.
Okay. Well, see, I think when different people have different opinions about something, unless they're all correct, then someone's wrong. And I don't think conflicting opinions about the same subject can both be right in most cases. Anyway, you've shared your position.
Hey? I haven't heard from these pastors anything different in their end result.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate your call very much. Shanti from Hollister, California. You're next. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Steve. How are you doing today?
Your voice is kind of garbled. Your phone is not very good.
Okay. Well, let me get out here a little while.
Okay. I might be able to understand you. Go ahead.
Okay. Can you understand me now?
I think a little better.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, you were talking about Revelation. Can you hear me better?
I can hear you well enough. I heard you say that we're talking about Revelation.
Okay. Can you hear me better now?
Oh, that's much better. Much better.
Okay,
yes.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay.
We're talking about Revelation. And, you know, I haven't finished reading Revelations, but I do believe in Revelations. And what's happening now, I think the devil is already here. And, people go through so many trials. People are going through so many trials now, you know, and the things, I mean, the world is just upside down. And,
all right.
You know, and I do believe, to be honest with you, that Satan is already here. I mean, he's been here all over, but especially now, you know, he tries to take people's souls. And if people don't shape up.
Okay. So, but actually, did you have a question or maybe a point of disagreement with me to bring up?
Actually, just a little point of kind of like a disagreement with you.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry. But
that's okay.
I do believe in Revelation. You know, I know that.
So do I. So do I. I wrote a commentary on Revelation, 600 pages. I believe in the book completely.
Right. But, you know, the way I see it now, you know, Satan is already here.
I know. And you said that. And I agree. I agree Satan's here also. And I think we all agree about that. I appreciate your saying so. Now, it seems to me like the theme music was supposed to start about a half a minute ago. And what's been happening lately on the program is the music starts and the program is like over. And so I need to be, I'm not going to wait for the music today. There it is. I'm going to just have to sign off because I'm off in just 60 seconds right now. I appreciate all who've called. It's interesting. It's almost been kind of like a forum on people's opinions about Revelation, which is fine. It's an open line, and so people can do that here. But for those of you who are new listeners, we don't usually have everybody calling on one subject. This is just an open Q&A forum Monday through Friday for an hour each weekday afternoon. And we'd like you to become a regular listener if you'd like. The Narrow Path is the name of the ministry, and the website is thenarrowpath.com. I mentioned my lectures. You can get them for free at the website, thenarrowpath.com. You can also donate from there if you want to. We are listener-supported. Or you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you. Thank you.